I think I'm just going to read you that bit of the poem again that I read you in the tea break. I read you the whole little bit, not the whole poem, as I say. So, yeah, so just in case you didn't hear, this is part of a poem by Philip Larkin, in which the poet has gone back to the university he used to be at and discovered, slight to his kind of consternation, that somebody he was at university with already has a son who's old enough to be at university themselves. And that gets the poet musing on the different choices people make in life. That, you know, here's his old university friend with a son, and here's the poet, he's not got a son. And he's thinking, well, obviously, yeah, this person must have thought it was a good thing to have a son, and obviously somehow I must have thought it was a good thing not to have a son. And then he asks himself this question: where do these innate assumptions come from? Not from what we think truest or most want to do. Those warp tight shut like doors. They're more a style our lives bring with them, habit for a while. Suddenly, they harden into all we've got and how we got it. Looked back on, they rear like sand clouds, thick and close, embodying for Dockery a sun, for me nothing, nothing at all, with all a sun's harsh patronage. Life is first boredom, then fear. Whether or not we use it, it goes and leaves what something hidden from us chose, and age, and then the only end of age. So, quite a serious poem. And why I've chosen to read that tonight is I think it very much illustrates, as I was saying in the tea break, what we're saying, what we're trying to say using this image of the wheel of life. This image, the wheel of life being, as David Mitra said, the image of the reactive mind, kind of the unfulfilled mind. The reactive mind is the mind that is just caught up in habit, that doesn't really choose. And this is what's happening to the poet in this poem. You know, he's musing, yeah, that our assumptions don't come from what we think truest or most want to do. These shut tight like doors, you know, so we haven't got access to what we think truest. We're just driven on by habit, which hardens into all we've got. So that's quite strong, isn't it? But it's true. Our habits harden and they create our worlds, literally. So they create our worlds because they create our assumptions. So the poet's saying, embodying, in other words, it's not just that it goes on in our minds, it comes into reality. Embodying for Dockery a son, for me nothing. Nothing with all a son's harsh patronage. So he hasn't got a son, but he's got the sort of not a son, you know, that's still a something. It's not a son that's affecting him, yeah? And then he says, life is first boredom. So I guess that's sort of youth, when you're thinking, what am I going to make of it? But then fear, as you realise this monster of impermanence, you start to realise, oh gosh, there really is this monster of impermanence, then fear. Whether or not we use it, whether or not we use our life, it goes and leaves what something hidden from us chose. Yeah, so something that we're not aware of makes the choices that become our life, not just what we think, but what we are, because we are what we think, and age, and then the only end of age. So that's like impermanence, yeah? So in a way, you could say that poem and that wheel of life are the same thing. So this is what we're calling reactive mind. And I like this poem as well, because it really is emphasising reactive mind. It's not that we're bad, you know, it's not that we're like sort of bad people, and it's not that we probably, most of us, do anything like really, really terrible. I mean, we might make mistakes, and maybe occasionally we do something like pretty bad, but most of the time we just don't quite know what we're doing, but we've got to do something, so we've got to live. So we don't quite know what we're doing. We sort of trundle along, but then it turns into something, and then we think, oh, well, how did this happen? And what the Dharma offers us is a way out of this, is a way into awareness and a way completely to something completely different, a life that isn't gripped by this monster of impermanence, that isn't first boredom, then fear. Yeah, so it offers us a different life. So, you know, I almost wish you could say to Philip Larkin back at him, oh, you know, there is something. He knew there was something, but he didn't know what it was. You feel that in the poems as well. Other poems, like he goes into churches and he knows there must be something more. Anyway, so that's the sort of theme. That's the theme of these weeks. And what I want to explore a bit more tonight follows on from what we talked about last week. Who was here last week, out of interest? Okay, so about a third of the people here. Okay, so that's fine, because each week stands alone as well. So last week, as David Mitra said, we talked about, do you see these six larger segments kind of third out? So you've got the half of the wheel of life, driven by greed, hatred and delusion. You've got that black and white segment, and then you've got these six segments, which are called the six realms. Can everybody see the bit that they're meaning? So basically, these six realms, looked at sort of psychologically, as it were, they're like the objectification of different states of mind that we find ourselves in, yeah? So basically, these are the realms that if we're unenlightened, we'll be in one or other of these realms. And we might be in all of them in the course of a single day or even hour. And we'll probably spend more time in some of the realms than others of the realms. But if we're not enlightened, that means we're in one of these realms, yeah? Maybe I'll just quickly say what they are, and then we'll go over them in more detail. So you've got the God realm, that's the one at the top that looks very bright. So the God realm is the objectification of the state of mind of kind of quite heightened pleasure. It might be the state of mind that you'll have at the end of the winter retreat if you go. where you maybe, it's the state of kind of higher states of meditation, sort of states of artistic, so, you know, maybe if you're, I don't know, listening to some amazing piece of music or in an art gallery and you're uplifted by that, that's the state of being in the God realm. The next realm is called the Asuras or Titans. That's the realm of competition and jealousy. So that's quite a different sort of realm. That's a realm of power, really, power struggle, whether that's overt through fighting or less overt through manipulation, yeah? It's the realm of power struggle, of trying to get the better of other people, yeah? So that's that realm. The next realm is the realm of the hungry ghosts. That's the realm of neurotic craving, really. The beings in that realm have got tiny mouths and huge bellies to show that nothing, they can never be satisfied with what they're trying to satisfy themselves with. Bhante Sangharajita, our teacher, for those of us who are ordained, he describes neurotic craving as where you want something from the thing that it can't give you, yeah? So it's like where you want, you know, I don't know, it's kind of where you comfort eat or whatever. You want something from the thing that you're eating or drinking or consuming in some other way that it cannot give you. So it's a sort of tragic realm, that hungry ghost realm. And also it's sort of addictive. So you can't, the more you try and fill yourself with what can't satisfy you, the kind of worse it gets, you know, it's sort of narcotic, it kind of goes on like that. And what's the next one? The next one's the hell realm, so that's the realm of acute suffering. That's a realm of acute, in terms of in psychological states, it would be acute mental anguish, and it could be physical suffering as well. Not always, sometimes people rise above physical suffering, don't they? But often physical suffering, if it's very intense, leads to mental anguish. And then you've got the animal realm. So the animal realm doesn't mean like literally animals necessarily. It means more the state, the psychological state of just being dominated by where you're just in, where all you're just kind of all you care about is the body and its concerns, like food and sex and sleep. It's like when you're in that mode of that's all your concern. And then the human realm, which I'm going to spend a bit longer on this evening, which again isn't it more or less overlaps with the state of being embodied as a human being, but not totally. Yeah. Is that them all? Have I done six?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Okay. So that is the state. If you're not enlightened, you're in one or other of those realms. Do people recognise those realms as places they inhabit from? Yeah. So the important thing is whatever realm you're in, there's almost potential for enlightenment. Yeah. Whatever realm you're in, none of them are permanent. Yeah. So the hell realm isn't like the Christian idea of hell, which I was brought up with. I was brought up as a Catholic in quite a literalistic way, where like hell was, well, that was it. You never got out. Basically, if you went to hell, if you were a Catholic, you never, ever, ever got out of hell. That was what made it hell in a way, that you never got out of it. I don't know if people are brought up like that these days. But certainly that's what I was taught. Anyway, the Buddhist idea of the hell realm is not that at all, because it's not permanent. Same with the God realm, isn't a permanent heaven or anything. So none of these realms are permanent. Also, they're permeable from one to the other. And whatever realm you're in, there is potential for enlightenment in the realm. But some of them, there's more potential for enlightenment than others. So I thought that might be quite a good place to start tonight. And Dhruva Mitra and I, who are like teaching this seminar, and well, all anybody who's teaching here, we're not, I hope this is clear, that we're not just teaching this as an academic, or this is what Buddhism says. It's so that we can sort of hopefully use these teaching in our own lives. So how you might use this teaching in your own life is just to notice, oh, what realm am I in? And then we can start over the course of this evening. Hopefully I'm going to get us to a point that you'll be able to identify what realm you're in, and also what's your next step from that realm. Because there's always potential for enlightenment from any of these realms, that means there's always a next step, whatever realm you're in. There's always a next step, and we'll be going on to that. So that's why... That's why the awareness of a teaching like this is good, and awareness of ourselves is good. So you can start to see, well, what's my next step? What can I do to help myself? Yeah. But I thought it might be kind of fun to start to identify which of these realms, although I've said all of them have got potential for enlightenment, some of them are better, spiritually speaking, than others. And this, there's also a traditional teaching about this, which I thought was Tibetan, but Dhruva Mitra told me was Chinese. And that each of these realms have got within them seeds. Seeds are a lovely image, actually, because it's a total image of potential. So each of these realms have got clusters of seeds within them, according to this Chinese teaching. And there's three kinds of seeds. There's good seeds, bad seeds, and Buddha seeds. I think good seeds means pleasant seeds. This is the way I'm interpreting it. that there's pleasure seeds, there's pain seeds, and there's Buddha seeds, yeah? So this is just a little, it's kind of fun to sort of guess, but it's kind of educative as well. So I thought we could just go round the realms and we could make a guess at what seeds of being potential are in each realm. So we're going to start with the God realm. So if I was to ask you what proportion of, so let's do it in proportions, yeah? So there's a whole bunch of seeds in the God realm. So what proportion of seeds in the God realm do you think are pain, seeds of pain? None. Right, correct answer. Great, good. What proportion of seeds are pleasure seeds, as it were?
Lots,
yeah. How many Buddha seeds do you think there are in the God realm? A lot or a little?
A little.
A little, that is the correct answer. So why are there not many Buddha seeds, potential Buddha seeds in the God realm?
Because they're a bit complacent up there and they're a bit complacent.
Yeah.
That everything's good already,
yeah.
So there's no need to transform.
Yeah, exactly. That is the correct answer. Yeah. It's the realm of complacency. And that is the big, big danger of the God realm. The God realm is important, spiritually speaking, because it's important to have pleasure. It's great to go on a retreat and really experience God. Life can, just with meditation, life can become so much more pleasant. So that is really important. But there's a danger in that one can get complacent and stop practicing. And I know this quite well because this happens to me quite a lot. So whenever I go on retreat, I love going on retreat, and at the end of the retreat I usually feel great, you know. And then I know by experience, this is what you learn if you've been practicing for a while, you start to learn things like the art of coming off retreat. So for me, the art of coming off retreat is not to get complacent, because I feel fantastic and I kind of feel, I don't just feel good, I feel like, I don't know, I feel like I feel inflated and intoxicated. I kind of think I'm the bee's knees and I've got it cracked, you know. And I think, oh, look at me. I totally like feel great. I'm just totally going to be in this positive state forever because I'm like, I've transformed myself. And then I let my practice of meditation and other things slip. And it only takes a few days and I have a massive crash. Yeah? And it's sort of pride, actually, because what I'm not remit. All I would have to do, what the trick would be for me is to learn, and I am trying to learn this after all these years, is to enjoy feeling great, but reflect, what were the conditions of this feeling great? Okay, yes, I've been meditating 4 hours a day, I've been not on my mobile phone the whole time, I've been not doing loads of emails the whole time, I've been in the company of other people who are practicing. Actually, I am in the company of other people who are practicing most of the time, but I've been studying the Dharma daily. So remembering the conditions and keeping going with those conditions. If I was to do that, then actually I would keep progressing, yeah? But I'm afraid I still tend to forget and fall back. Yeah? So it's not sort of bad to be in the God realm, but it's a bit spiritually dangerous, and that's why there's only 3 Buddha seeds. I don't know how they exactly count them, but in the little picture I've got, there's only 3 Buddha seeds, yeah? So, okay, so the next realm, so this is the realm of competitiveness and either overt fighting and trying to get the better of other people or manipulation, but it's manipulation, yeah, to just try and get on top, basically. So what proportion of sort of pain seeds are in this realm of fighting and so on?
40%.
Mm-hmm. About 40%? Yeah, I think that looks like about right from my list. It looks more like about 40-50%, yeah. What about pleasure seeds? Mm-hmm. About the same, yeah, actually. That's interesting, isn't it? They're slightly less in my little picture, but about the same, because it can feel kind of good, can't it? I suppose you get the pleasure seeds if you're the one who's winning, and you get the pain seeds if you're the one who's losing. So that's quite interesting. It's very, very, very conditioned, and that's what reactive mind is. You'll only get the pleasure if you're winning the fight, as it were. Either you've manipulated your way to the top or you've fought your way to the top. Then it will feel like great, you know, but kind of precarious. So even in the pleasure, there probably is pain, because you know you could lose it. You're always going to be having to watch your back all the time, yeah? So even in the pleasure, there's pain. And if you're the one losing, it's all pain.
Pleasure in taking part as well.
Say that again?
Pleasure in taking part in the fight.
Say that again, sir?
The pleasure in taking part in the fight.
Yes, it can be feel good, can't it? To be in that sort of warrior-like mode, yeah. Yeah, I think that's true. Often even that kind of...
excitement.
Yeah, that tightens, that's what it is. Yeah, it can feel really, you can feel good. You can get that sort of adrenaline sort of rush, can't you? Yeah. Yeah. How many Buddha seeds do you think are in this realm?
22.
22? Any advances on that?
Less.
Well, yes, because you've already got a clue, because you've got roughly half and half or so in the pleasure and pain.
Five, one
Buddha seed, of course. So that's interesting, even less than the gods. So it's interesting there is one, because no realm's got none, but there's only one, according to this picture. There's only one. Okay, so we'll come back to why that might be. There's only one, but there is one, so that's good. Okay, what about the hungry ghosts? These tiny mouth, huge belly, trying to eat everything they eat, turns into excrement, or everything they drink turns into fire. How many pleasure seeds are in the hungry ghost realm?
None.
How many proportion of pain seeds?
99%.
Hmm? What was that?
99.
Interesting enough, not. Maybe I ask the question the other way around. How many Buddha seeds?
What exactly are the Buddha seeds?
Hmm?
What exactly are the Buddha seeds?
The Buddha seeds are the sort of potential for enlightenment. Well, there's always potential for enlightenment. The sort of seeds that can ripen into Buddhahood. They're the Buddha seeds. That's good. I'm glad you asked me to clarify. The seeds that can ripen into Buddhahood. Mm-hmm.
A lot, because there's a desire to transform from that.
Yes, that is interesting. There's quite a lot. There's more pain seeds. So in my picture, there's about 75% pain seeds, but there's about 25% Buddha seeds, much more than in the fighting realm. And if that's exactly the thing that you said, that there is desire to transform. And I think there's a really, really important... Dharmic teaching in this is that, and I think I'm quite keen to say this, in that desire in itself is not a bad thing. And I want to say that, because often we can hear, oh, Buddhism is all about getting rid of desire. Actually, desire for enlightenment, desire for all beings to be happy and well, desire to change the world to be a better place, that's really positive. So a desire to transform... Desire itself is not negative. What goes wrong is we try and fulfill that desire with things that can't fulfill it. Yeah, that's what that image is of the tiny mouths and so on. But desire itself can be positive. We need desire or we'd never grow. Yeah, we'd just be, I don't know, if we didn't have desire, what would we be, you know? It's desire that does actually drive us forward. And that's, I find that very kind of compassionate message, that it's not our desire in a sense that's wrong or bad. It's just we're looking to fulfill our desire from things that can't possibly fulfill it. And in doing that, we increase the propensity to do that. So the more we do that, the more we will do it. But that's why there's quite a high proportion of Buddha seeds, I think, that... What we've got to do is harness that desire, sort of stop trying to fill it with the wrong things and use it, like to sort of transform our desire for things and objects and people and so on into a desire for, you know, our own growth and the well-being of all beings, yeah? So that's really important.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, of course you can.
How is there no pleasure seat in that realm? Because I would have thought there would have to be some pleasure before,
well, that's
like for the initial, whatever they're eating or drinking, the initial pleasure.
There might have been at one time, but by the time you've got, maybe, that's a good question, isn't it? Maybe there was at one time pleasure, but by the time you've got in this realm, there's no pleasure anymore. Or it's probably the kind of, the epitome would be like the addict, maybe, who there was once pleasure, but by the time they're in this realm, they're all their whole effort is like, you know, trying to get the next, whatever they're addicted to. So there would only be pain, yeah.
But if you're addicted to something, you're chasing pleasure.
You're chasing pleasure, yeah. And they definitely are.
Mm.
They're trying to, but they're trying to go for the wrong thing. So they would, by the time of this realm, there's only the pain. Yeah, it might have started off that you've tasted the pleasure. It's a bit like, I mean, the classic thing of, the first square of chocolate is pleasurable, second is quite pleasurable, but it's a law of diminishing returns. So by the time you're fully in that, the returns have diminished so much that the pain has overtaken the pleasure.
The chocolate.
And remember, it's interesting because they are, because this is a visual image, it looks like these segments are, you know, like slices of cake or something that were in one. But they're kind of permeable. But so that would be the extreme of this. The extreme of this hungry ghost would be there'd be no pleasure left. But most of the time we're probably a bit in one, a bit in the other. Do you see what I mean? You can imagine them. And also the whole thing's meant to be spinning around the whole time. So we're spinning around. But that would be the extreme of the hungry ghost. No pleasure at all. But quite a lot of Buddha says. Okay, how about hell? Any pleasure? No pleasure. Any Buddha seeds?
About half.
But there's about a third again, a little bit more than in the hungry ghost. But you're right in your instinct, there's quite a few. So why do you think? And interestingly, far more than in the God realm. Far more Buddha seeds than in the God realm. Why do you think that is?
Is it a bit like when you reach the bottom?
Yeah.
You can only come
up. I think that's it. Yeah, and often when you reach that bottom, it kind of propels you. You think, I've got to do something about this, haven't you? I've got to do something. Yeah. So quite a lot of Buddha seeds in that hell realm. Obviously loads of like painful. Okay, the animal, so remember this isn't a literal animal, it's the state of, where all we're concerned about is our, you know, sleep and sex and food. But it does overlap with the actual animal realm. Interestingly enough, maybe I'll just tell you this. I think it does overlap with the actual animal because there's a lot of pain seeds in this. Because you'd think there might be quite a lot of pleasure because of all the sense pleasure. I think there's a lot of pain because it overlaps with the actual animal realm where, you know, there's just, you know, they're eating each other and so on. So there's a fight for survival. So traditionally there's a lot of pain in this animal realm and hardly any pleasure. But strangely, quite a few Buddha seeds. I've told you the answer to this one. So that's interesting, and I think that again completely differs to say the Christianity where I was growing up, where humans and animals were definitely, you know, that humans went to heaven but animals didn't, you know. But actually there's quite a good number, maybe about 20% it looks like to me, of Buddha seeds in that animal realm, yeah. So that shows that there's not a fixed boundary line. It's not in Buddhism, it's not like we are the humans and we've got dominion or something over animals. There's potential for growth in the animal realm. Okay, so and then the human realm in terms of proportion, so what proportion of pleasure? Oh yeah, was that a question?
Sorry, yeah, I just wanted to ask a question about the animal realm.
Yeah.
Does that mean that animals could become Buddhists or animals could become enlightened?
It seems like it. They possibly would have to pass through the human realm first. Yeah, that it definitely, I mean, according to traditional Buddhism, all sentient life can become enlightened, even some teachings, although this is beyond where my imagination can stretch, talks about even blades of grass and so on. That, to me, is beyond my imagination, but all life, I suppose all life has a potential for growth, and if there's a potential for growth, there's a potential for Buddhahood. Yeah.
But animals are not reflective, are they, you know?
Exactly.
It's
hard to see, isn't
yeah.
it?
Okay.
So that's why I think we can't get completely rid, because we'll come on to that distinctive thing about the self-reflectiveness of human beings. But maybe animals with more intelligence can, well, it's interesting because this involves sort of rebirth and everything. It's kind of interesting with the human and animal, because we know those are literal realms. I mean, the Tibetan tradition would think all these realms were literal and there were actual gods flying about and hell beings. We are more used to the animal and human, and we've got them as literal realms, but also as psychological states. So maybe it's more we can move from that psychological unself-reflectiveness into self-reflectiveness and then move on. And then maybe even animals with more intelligence can be reborn as humans if we believe in rebirth and grow in that way. Yeah. How about the human realm in terms of proportionally? So, pleasure seeds?
50.
Hmm?
50%?
50. Evenly split? One third. Yeah, that's the right answer. Yeah, so that's interesting, isn't it? So, it's exactly one third each. So, the important thing is there's equal pleasure and pain in the human realm. That's one of the things that defines it. And then there's a third Buddha seeds, which is the most Buddha seeds. It's more than slightly more than the hell realm, and slightly more than the hungry ghost realm. We're going to come back to that, especially the equal pleasure and pain. So that's to me, I find that very, very interesting to think of the different potential, especially the potential for Buddhahood and the different realms. Remember that these realms are the realms we all find ourselves in, so there might be something to reflect on, especially if we find ourselves in that jealous realm. If we want enlightenment, if we want growth, we probably better get out of it quite quick. And same with the God realm, we have to be careful in the God realm. One more thing I want to tell you about these realms, and some of you know this, have been studying this already, is each of the realms, do you see a Buddha appears in each of the realms? So the Buddha is representing, the way I think of it, as the next step. The Buddha is bringing something, but I think we can think of that as what do we need when we're in each of these realms as our next step, yeah? So, and what is interesting is the Buddha brings something that's both useful and completely appropriate to each of the realms, as we'll see. So maybe people who can see could even say, so what's the Buddha bringing in the God realm?
A guitar,
yeah. So why do you think that's what do you think is the message of that?
Rock and roll,
yeah. What do you think? It's an actual lute. What do you think? What's being played on the lute?
Something that people can relate to.
Yeah, so they can relate to it. So that's true. It's because the God realm probably isn't rock and roll, actually, because the God realm is probably more like Mozart or Beethoven or something. Refined. So they can relate to it because they're these God realms. And also, the lute is playing the music of impermanence. So that lute, and music itself is actually impermanent, even its being, because it's teaching them to remember not to be complacent, that they're not going to be in this God realm forever. Yeah? So it's the lute of impermanence. What is the Buddha bringing the next and the hungry ghost?
Sword.
So not the hungry ghost, sorry, the titans. Sword. So what do you think the message of the sword is?
Wisdom.
Wisdom, yeah. So the sword is wisdom, and you can see it's completely appropriate. You know, the lute isn't going to work in the titan realm, is it? And the same as the sword isn't going to work in the god realm. So the sword is very traditionally used for as a symbol of wisdom in Buddhism because it cuts through ignorance. But you see how kind of clever it is, because it's saying, actually, that kind of energy that wants to fight, that energy that wants to kill and even destroy, use that energy to destroy ignorance. Use that energy to destroy wrong views. Use your competitive spirit to fight for good in the world. Do you see how it's using the very thing? It's not saying, oh, you're bad people, you're also jealous and competitive. You know, it's not kind of coming and giving them a big ticking off and moral lesson. It's sort of speaking to us when we're in that mode in language we can understand and saying, use that very energy, but use it for the good, yeah? So that's the sword. And then maybe I'll tell you the next one. So in the hungry ghost realm, the Buddha brings Amrita nectar, which is actually, it's a bit like something that they can actually, that will satisfy. Yes, the Amrita means the nectar of the deathless. So that ties in with the search for enlightenment, saying, you're not wrong to search, you know, you're not wrong to sort of be seeking something beyond this sort of worldly existence, but you're looking in the wrong place. Here's the right place to look. Look towards the deathless, yeah? The deathless, yeah? So Amrita nectar. Amrita means the deathless. So they basically look to Buddhahood, look to kind of get off this whole wheel completely, yeah? That doesn't mean get off life completely. It means go beyond this wheel. Yeah, you won't find it just with going round and round. But there is something more. You're not wrong to seek, you know. You're not wrong to have this intuition of there's more to life than this. And then in the hell realm, the Buddha brings just, again, like nectar, but it's just like almost like just like cool water, you know, just something to soothe the beings first and foremost. I think there's a saying, isn't there, that people in hell just need a drink of water. So you just have to find something. If you're in that hell room, you just have to find you have to find your inspiration again. You know, if you're completely lost and sort of wandering in a sort of abyss, you just have to find your inspiration. And I've got a lovely story in relation to that. I might have told it before, but I'll tell it again. It was Bhante Sangharakshita. He's in his 90s now, so he's too old to kind of go around and about and teach. But about 15 years ago, when he was 75, he was still able to come occasionally and give talks and so on. Anyway, he came here to the Buddhist Centre. I wasn't here, but a friend told me about him. I came here to the Buddhist Centre, and he did a question and answer session with order members. And all the order members had put their questions into a hat, I want to say, some sort of receptacle in advance, yeah? And then they were just being taken out one by one. And my friend told me that the questions were a bit, I don't know, they were a bit academic. People were saying, what about this strand of Buddhism and that? And Bhante was dutifully answering them. And the questions were all anonymous, yeah? And then there was a question, and the question was, what do you do when you just, all your inspirations just run out, you just have got no inspiration left, and you just don't know what to do next? What do you do? And my friend said at that moment, Bhante just completely came alive. And she said he looked straight at the person who'd asked the question, even though he didn't know that they'd asked the question. And he said, what you need to do is you just need to find something that gives you joy. And he said, you know, for example, you, and he looked straight at, that was the point, he looked straight. He said, you looked really happy when you were playing your drums at the Buddhafield Festival. Like, just go and play your drums and just do what gives you. Don't worry if it's dharmic, don't worry if it's like spiritual. Just do something that brings you joy, you know? And I thought, what a lovely story. And to me, that was like when somebody's in that hell realm of despair, you know, you don't start, I don't know, reading them a whole the Dhammapada or something, you know, reading them a whole thing. You just need to say, oh, what connects you with joy? What kind of gets you your inspiration? That's the first step. So that's, so, you know, you need to, you know, don't, I really like that, the Bhante said, don't worry if it's dharmic or not. Just get your, look for what gives you your inspiration and joy. So that's what the Buddha brings in that realm. In the animal realm, the Buddha brings a book that represents culture. So if we find ourselves, you know, I don't know, say we don't go on retreat at Christmas and we're just watching the telly and eating our Christmas dinner, that's what I always think of as the animal realm, you know. You need to, if you find yourself in that sort of, you know, animal sort of almost stupor really, you need to kind of lift, you know, the book represents, it might not be a literal book, but what's going to uplift you a bit and get you out of just your sort of more kind of animal nature. It's not that that's bad, your animal nature, but what can kind of get you a bit more awake in a way. And then in the human realm, you see the Buddha with a begging bowl and a staff. So that what that represents is, when you find yourself in the human state, I'm going to talk about more about what the human state means, is the next step is take up meditation, take up, I don't want to say the Dharma life, because I don't even want to say that you, it makes it even sound too Buddhist-y, but take up the path of growth, take up the path of growth. And actually the other way around is also true, that if you want to take up the path of growth, of spiritual growth, the first step is to become a happy, healthy human being. So work on that first. But then when you find yourself a happy, healthy human being, take up the path of growth. But don't wait to be perfect before you take up the path of growth. Basically, you just need to be basically happy and healthy, then take up the path of growth. Just going to check your time. Okay.
Why does the staff represent?
It's just a traditional, it's the kind of traditional what a monk or nun would have, but they would have just two possessions, their robe, their staff and their bowl. So they might not mean literally go forth as a monk or nun, but it means take up the path of growth, yeah? So you can imagine the mendicant just walking with their staff. I wanted to go into little groups, but I've run out of time as ever. I've talked too much, but I just need to do it all together. So I want to just concentrate a little bit more on what does it mean to be human, yeah? That's a huge question, actually. What does it mean to be human? And what I want to say is it doesn't literally just mean having a human body, yeah? In the Tibetan tradition, again, and there's this notion of the precious human birth, and that is the that precious human birth is almost a compound term, and it's a translation of a term that means not just with a human form, but means with a human form, and the traditional is to have a human form with the 8 freedoms and the 10 endowments and the 3 kinds of faith. Yeah, so the precious human birth means being human, but also having these 8 freedoms, 10 endowments, and 3 kinds of faith. Now, I'm not going to say what they all are because it's too long a list, but what I will say is these 8 freedoms and 10 endowments are often things that we, especially in our Western world, take for granted. So, for example, it includes things like that we certainly at the moment, although there's many wars in the world and our countries might even be involved in some of them, we're not in a war-torn region right at the moment. If we were, we could still practice, but it'd be really, really hard. Yeah, it'd be really, really hard if we weren't allowed to come and sit here and talk about the Dharma. So for example, my friend Vedra Çakçu, who's in Turkey, oh gosh, maybe I shouldn't say this one too. No, I'm sure I can. You know, it's more difficult. It's more difficult. You can't advertise, like, the, you know, we just put our posters up and our flyers out. You can't do that. We take that for granted, that we can just go and give a flyer out because we can all come here. I remember, again, I've said this before, but it's worth saying again, when I lived in Dublin, I was teaching at the Trinity College in Dublin, just a little meditation class, and there was a Chinese man teaching also meditation, a different type, in the next door room. So we're both teaching. And then it was the summer break. And then I came back, and when I came back after the summer break, all the students were signing a petition. I said, oh, what's your petition for? And basically the petition was for that guy who was teaching meditation, had gone back to China and got arrested as soon as he went into China for teaching meditation. And I just thought, blimey, like, because we were doing the exact same thing. And of course, it never crossed my mind. I just completely took it for granted, oh, I can just go in this university and teach meditation. You know, it wasn't even in my consciousness at all. Is that something you could get arrested for, yeah? So some of these freedoms and endowments include things that we take for granted, that we live in a time where we still can hear about the Buddha's teachings. I mean, eventually, in centuries to come, that will die out. It will be lost, you know, because it's impermanent, like everything else. Easy to think, oh, it'll always be alive, but it won't be. Buddhism has died out in other countries. It will die out in this country. The Sangha will die out. It's quite good from time to time to reflect on the conditions that we've got. We might have some ill health, but we're well enough to have come here at least, you know, and be with each other and practice and meditate. You know, we might complain about our National Health Service, but we do live in a country where we can get medical treatment. Sometimes I think that when I take a painkiller, you know, you can get them for like 19 pence out of Tesco's, can't you? Paracetamol. I thought, God, like, imagine if I lived in a country where you couldn't even get a painkiller. It'd be really, really hard to practice if you had even something quite simple, like a headache or a toothache, that you couldn't just take a paracetamol for 19 pence out of Tesco's, you know. Of course, you could still practice, but very, very hard, you know. So it's quite good to reflect on these endowments and freedoms we have, because if we reflect on them, we're more likely to make the most of our precious human birth. The fact we are born as a human, we're in this human realm, but we've got these freedoms and endowments. And of course, so that's one thing about the human realm. The precious human birth has these freedoms and endowments. And of course, we have this, as you said, this self-reflective awareness, which allows us to choose and to change. And that is, according to traditional Buddhism, rare and priceless, yeah? That we've got self-reflexive awareness. And there's all sorts of traditional Tibetan images for this, like how rare it is to be born a human being. They say it's as rare as floating on the surface of the ocean as a wooden yoke. And 100 years, a turtle pokes its head up to the surface of the ocean. The precious human birth is rare as that turtle poking its head through that yoke, yeah? And again, what that's trying to say is make the most of it, because we don't know when, you know, these conditions can change, yeah? And also, the other thing about these rare and precious conditions we've got is they come with a responsibility, really. To actually make the most of them and not be like, you know, the person in Philip Larkin's poem where, you know, the choices have just been made by something hidden, yeah? We've got the self-reflexive awareness that means it doesn't have to be hidden. That's really why we practice meditation as Buddhists. As I said, it's not just, the other week, it's not just to become more calm and stress-free. It includes that. but it's so that we can choose and change. So when we find ourselves in the human realm, make the most of it, because in the other realms, as we know, much harder to choose. Much, you know, if we're already in a skillful, if we're already not in a skillful state, much harder to become skillful. If we're in that hungry ghost realm, it's possible to get out, but it's hard to get out of it. Once we're in it, it's hard to get out of it. So the wise thing to do is, if we're not in it, don't allow ourselves to get in it, you know. If we're not in that ashra state, that Titan state, choose and change not to go in it, because once you're in it, harder to get out of. Once you're in that hell realm, harder to get out of, yeah? Possible to get out of, and that's why we've got the teaching, but much harder. So do you sort of see what, can you start, does this make sense of why the teaching of the realms can be quite useful to us? So notice when you're in the, whichever realm you're in, see what your next step is, but especially notice when you're in the properly human state of just being, you know, there's not so much pain that you're overwhelmed, there's not so much pleasure that you're intoxicated, there's that equal balance, as we said, and realise, oh, this is really good conditions for growth. That's why there's all these Buddha seeds in it. And choose and change. And then that's when you can start to be in creative mind and get off this wheel altogether, yeah? And the more you choose and change, the positive, the more perspective you've got. Again, that can be a definition of being properly human, is having perspective. It goes with a reflexive awareness. That you don't identify with your mental states. It's a precursor of wisdom, having perspective. It's interesting, people often ask me, you know, they might ask me how long I've been meditating, and I say 30 odd years, and they often say, does it get easier? And I think the answer to that I often feel is the truest answer, is it's not totally it gets easier, but you get perspective on the difficulties. You learn how to handle the difficulties and don't make a drama of the difficulties. So I might still sit down and get distracted in meditation, but I know how to work with it. I know how to not identify it. I know how to not allow myself to go, oh God, that means you're a terrible meditator, you should just give up. What I have learned is you kind of think, okay, that happens, distraction happens, that's what minds do. Don't identify with it, don't take it personally, don't make a drama out of it, just go to see the next step. I think that's what changes over years of practice. Still, there are still difficulties, but you learn to have perspective, yeah? And I think that's probably distinctly human in this way that we're using it. And also we can build on perspective until it becomes complete, the wisdom of the Buddha, which is panoramic awareness, yeah? So I think that is more or less all we've got time for. But I want to read you, since I began with a poem, and the poem was about being on the wheel of life, I want to read you another poem, an ancient Tibetan poem by a teacher called Tsongkhapa, that gives us, it just gives us the other perspective, yeah? So why don't you just... close your eyes and let I'm going to read you this poem, and then that'll be the end of the evening. Okay. It's called The Human Body at Peace with Itself. So read the poem, then we'll just sit for half a minute, then I'll ring the bell. The human body at peace with itself is more precious than the rarest gem. Cherish your body. It is yours this one time only. The human form is one with difficulty. It is easy to lose. All worldly things are brief, like lightning in the sky. This life you must know as the tiny splash of a raindrop, a thing of beauty that disappears even as it comes into being. Therefore, set your goal, make use of every day and night to achieve it.